Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. I'm Father Ron Langwin, hoping that you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, especially the joy you feel when you share God's love with others. As we do each week, I'd like to begin our program with a story of Based on Faith, Form with Imagination, and kind of a platform to begin our discussion this evening. Two brothers who were respected and loved in their community came to see Jesus. No one knew there was a problem between them. Like grains of sand piled on top of one another, it had grown into a mountain and irritated both of them. Even though they were gentle by nature, one brother said to Jesus, "Master, I have watched you and listened to you, and you seem to be a just man. I must tell you, once there was love in my heart for my brother, but now there is only disdain." And then the younger brother said, "Master, I too once had great respect and love for my brother, because he cared for us when our father was growing old. He protected me and guided me, but now I feel rejected by his attitude. Master, tell us how we can settle our differences." Jesus looked at each of the brothers and said, "My friends, I want each of you to extend your arm to me." Both of them did as he directed and extended their right arms. But Jesus extended his left arm and said, "Each of you without thinking extended the same arm. Why cannot man work together like this and care for one another's needs like friends or brothers? Too often we will not even lift a hand to help another. We let them rest at our sides and we do nothing." That rock over there is heavy. If I asked both of you to help me to move it, you would have to use both of your hands. But if I told you that you could use only one, you would look around for someone kind enough to help you. I tell you this, man must live and work together when there are differences to be settled between them. He must speak truthfully about what is in his heart and not just say what he thinks people will want to hear. Jesus looked at the older brother and said, "You are wise and kind and gentle." To the younger brother, he said, "You are strong, understanding, and obedient. When you put these precious gifts together, you can feel the love of the Father. Each gift is beautiful in its own way, but their true power is only felt when they are combined." A story of faith and imagination. Our guest this evening writes in his latest book titled True Companions, a book for everyone about the relationships that see us through. When I began writing this book, I thought it was about saving this ancient institution called marriage. Seriously, I planned to right the sinking ship we call matrimony by convincing a whole generation of young people to quit jumping ship, to head to the courthouse, and to set sail upon the kind of life-changing journey marriage can become. Plus, quote-unquote, marriage books sell like hotcakes. It all seemed like a very good idea. Then one day a friend pushed back. She asked me about my next book, and when I told her what it was about, her face fell. "I love your writing," she explained, "but I can't pick up any book with marriage on the cover." She's a single woman. Men have been cruel to her. An uninterested father, a boyfriend who abandoned her in the middle of a pregnancy, a husband who drank their marriage to death. Now she has the courage to stand alone while raising her young daughter on her own. I can't blame her, so I wrote this book for her and for everyone like her. In her prize, Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Gilead, Marilyn Robinson writes, "The moon looks wonderful in this warm evening light, just as a candle flame looks beautiful in the light of morning, light within light. It seems to me to be a metaphor for the human soul, the singular light within the great general light of existence, or it seems like poetry within language, perhaps wisdom within experience, or marriage within friendship and love." And a guest then continues, "What if marriage is a singular light within the great general light of companionship? But we keep trying to turn it into the big light itself. What if uncovering the secrets to a stellar marriage isn't as important as finding our way to the truths at the heart of true companionship? This book is about the great general light of companionship, inside which marriage flickers and flames." And the author of these words and our guest once again with us, he was with us a couple of years ago, is Kelly Flanagan. He's a clinical psychologist and is the founder of Artisan Clinical Associates. It's a private practice in Naperville, Illinois, offering services to teens, adults, couples, and families. The author of Marriage Manifesto and Lovable. He has also written for publications such as Christianity Today, Reader's Digest, and Huffington Post. In 2014, a letter he wrote to his daughter led to their appearance on the Today Show. Flanagan is a popular blogger and speaks regularly on topics related to marriage, parenting, and social formation. Spiritual formation. He lives in Dixon, Illinois, with his wife Kelly, and their three children. Dr. Kelly Flanagan, welcome back to Amplify.
Thank you for having me back. 2 years, the world was pretty different. I think last time we talked, it was in the world was still sort of shut down.
Yes, and I didn't realize just till I read this book that your wife has the same, and you bring it up in the book, has the same first name as you. So it's Kelly Flanagan. So my producer didn't know whether it was a man or woman was going to be the guest.
Well, your producer is not the first person we've confused, that's for sure. Our names are spelled the same way. We both got our doctorate, so we lost the Mr. and Mrs. distinction. We fooled plenty of people along the way.
Well, you must have some fun with that at times, I'm sure.
We do.
In the beginning of the book, you write about the three forms of love found in the Greek language. Tell us a little bit about each of them as part of the foundation for our discussion this evening.
Yeah, of course. So that, you know, in the English language, we have really one word for love, but the Greeks had four words for love, and they were agape, storge, eros, and philia. And I honestly, when I started to write this book, I thought I was going to be writing a book about agape love, which is unconditional love. It's the kind of love that the Greeks often attributed to only the gods or to God. It's a divine sort of unconditional love. And I thought for sure I'm going to write a book about marriage that talks about what unconditional love looks like in marriage. Eros is the kind of love where, you know, we're all familiar with the beginning of a relationship and the sort of passion It's sort of the chemistry, it's the spark, it's often translates into physical intimacy. It's that intense, energetic sort of attraction at the beginning of a relationship. Storge is the kind of love that you feel amongst brothers, in the sense of like, I love you because we're related, we're kin, we're part of the same tribe. We sort of love each other because of our heritage and our ancestry. It's a given. It's a much sort of more factual kind of love. And then philia is best probably translated into the English language as companionship. It's the root of the name of the city, Philadelphia, on the other side of the state from you, Philia, the city of brotherly love. It's the kind of love that is shared between companions as they walk through life together. I appreciated so much the parable that you shared at the beginning about two brothers having to lift a rock together, to each with one hand. It's such a beautiful image of what companionship is. You think of life as like the rock that we're all just trying to carry, and together we can share life together and walk through it. And so as I started to write True Companions, what I realized is actually that's the love that transforms marriage into something even bigger, something even more beautiful. When instead of thinking about or sort of pretending to ourselves that we can love unconditionally, we actually think, how can I love like a companion? How can I walk through this life with you in an abiding sort of way? So those are the four Greek loves, and that's a little bit of a sense of how I sort of got attracted to this idea of philia as the topic of this book.
Yeah, why is philia so important?
You know, it's a great question. So the first thing that comes to mind is this was probably Wednesday this week. And I had I'd been in conversations with my 15-year-old son about a variety of things, and he had been sort of grumbling and complaining and resisting, you know, sort of watering the garden and taking out the garbage and just doing all these life things. It was just a lot of pushback. And then he came to me and he said, "Hey, Dad, can you take me to the YMCA so that I can work out?" And my first reaction was, "Quinn, I love you unconditionally, but I don't drive you unconditionally."
Yes.
You know, and it's this idea that unconditional love actually, in some ways, requires a little bit less sacrifice, a little bit less mutuality, a little bit less give and take than the gritty back and forth that is involved in doing life together. I can, it's simple for me to say, "Hey, Quinn, I love you unconditionally." It requires something else of both of us for me to say, "Hey, this life thing we're doing together, can you be all in on it? And I'll be all in on doing your life thing with you too. Can we mutually agree that we're going to do that?" That's philia, right?
Yes.
That's oh yeah, there's things to be done and I'm going to help you, and there's places to go and I'm going to get you there. And somehow, like, it's possible, and I think we see it in a lot of places, unconditional love can happen from very far away. It can, you know, those people over there who vote that way, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, I love them unconditionally, right? I mean, I would never spend a Sunday morning with them, but I love them unconditionally. And it sort of lets us off the hook for doing the real work of love in some ways when we use it that way. I don't believe that's how our God uses it, but as human beings, we tend to sort of want to use it that way, whereas philia doesn't give us any outs. It requires that we're sort of all in on participating in life together.
Yeah, the book is so so rich that I'm probably going to talk just about a little bit, give people a taste of it. But if they're here and there and everywhere to the end, right till the very end, but if there's a point in which you want us to stay a little bit longer, you please do that, okay? Step right in, because you would have a better sense than me. I was looking at our last interview and pulled out a couple of quotes, which made me think that indeed there is a bridge, of course, of here in the book. I like some of the things you said. Our loneliness is the shadow side of our uniqueness. I will always be alone within the experience of being me. It's simply a part of creation, the shadow side of our uniqueness. Our loneliness can warm us to grace. And you indicated that your most important insight of all was when it comes to true companionship, all the textbooks in the world are outweighed by a butterfly. And then then this last one, loneliness is the first taste of holiness.
Mm.
So let's move on, yeah. though, unless you can bring it up again, because you talk about companionship. Abandonment is the first chapter, is not loneliness. Tell us a little bit about the difference between of abandonment as you've experienced it and learned in your life. And I want to say, we learn a lot, learn about your wife. We probably should have had your wife on this program, because at the end of each chapter, you publish the letter that you sent to her.
Sure.
And, yeah. And both of you have the exact same name, Dr. Kelly Flanagan.
That's,
you know,
right.
And she seems like such a wonderful person. So different maybe than you and some of the things you do. And yet, what a lesson to be learned about where we really find love and companionship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the book brings that out. So tell us a little bit about abandonment as you have experienced and learned in your own life.
Yes, absolutely. I have to say, if I'd forced my wife in any way to come on this, that might have been the end of our companionship. She definitely doesn't love the public facing things.
Oh, that's
so much.
But, that's probably true. But reading the book and some of the other things that she did, she wouldn't have thought so much about, and agreed to do it.
I
might bet the opposite way. I might take the odds. But go ahead anyway.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Sure. So. One of the things that I discovered, back up one step here, that when you really slow down around the decision to get married for most people, what you discover sort of underneath the surface of it is the belief that I found the person who is going to take away my loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
And I often joke around and say, I mean, if you didn't think that, why would you get married? Because there's a lot of reasons it's hard. There better be some payoffs, right? So there's this inclination that I found the person who's going to take away my loneliness. And when we discover that they don't, then it leads to a whole cascade of conflict, of blame, of you must be doing something wrong because I still feel lonely. This must not be the right marriage or relationship for me because I'm still feeling lonely. And in my own personal journey and in my work with couples, one of the things I've discovered is that no one ever becomes completely unlonely in their life. It's baked into the operating system. And one of the things as I was working on writing True Companions that I began to discover is that it's actually not a bug either. It's a feature of being human, that it's in the places where we're most lonely, where we're most likely to encounter God at the center of us and at the center of our lives. And so I have that line you mentioned, loneliness is the first taste of holiness. Loneliness is God at first glance, I think I write in there somewhere. And so I brought that idea to my online tribe,
yes.
We have a monthly call where I get together with them and I share my latest thoughts and we dig in. And I said, hey, loneliness is the first taste of holiness. It's God at first glance. And they say, what, are you crazy, Dr. Kelly? Like, no way. Loneliness is the worst thing ever. And so this conversation ensued over the course of several months. And what I realized was when I say loneliness, what people hear is abandonment. They hear neglect. They hear they hear isolation. They hear shame. They hear all of these human experiences, and they sort of conflate them with loneliness. And so abandonment, as I talk about it in True Companions, is the experience of being left, against our own will, being left behind against our own will. And that can happen intentionally by a parent who decides to leave the family. Or it can happen unintentionally. My wife's father passed away when she was 3 of a heart attack. That's abandonment, even though no one did anything wrong. It was tragic. And so what I wanted to do early in the book was differentiate between the fact that we have painful experiences that happen to us, and these things like abandonment and neglect and shame and isolation. But loneliness is different from that. Loneliness is an artifact of the reality that none of us can feel totally seen and totally understood. If you had to look at two experiences that take away the feeling of loneliness for a while, it's that someone sees me and they understand me. But it can never last very long, and it can never go all the way to the center of us. And so loneliness with other human beings is just going to be an inevitable fact. Even when we're with the most wonderful people and they're trying really hard to see us and understand us, we'll always feel a little bit lonely. And so I wanted to talk in True Companions that in philia, in companionship, what we do is we don't expect you to take away my loneliness. I expect to share with you my loneliness, to tell you what it's like to be lonely. And you get to do the same thing with me. And suddenly that conversation about loneliness helps to ease it a little bit. But we're never expecting the other person to take it away completely.
And what I like about your book is it builds and takes its direction right through the chapter headings. So the first one is abandonment is not loneliness. And then they say, neither is it it's shame that loneliness is a fact of our humanness. Our minds are meaning-making machines. And loneliness is not a punishment. It's just a fact. Don't let your shame, you tell us, write the story about why your loneliness has surfaced. Then you also point out that nor is it isolation. Tell us a little bit about isolation. We just have a minute to our next break.
Yeah, so isolation, you know, is probably synonymous with being alone. Again, involuntarily alone. That there's really nobody watching at all. See, that's different from loneliness because we can have a whole group of people in our lives, a whole circle of belonging that is really interested in us. And they're paying attention, and they want to see us, and they want to understand us, but they can't entirely. They can't get inside of our skin. They can't get inside of our heart and inside of our head. And so we'll always be a little bit lonely. But isolation is really feeling like you don't have anybody watching. Nobody's really interested. Nobody's really curious about what it's like to be me. And unfortunately, we have more and more of that in our world as we become more and more disconnected and more isolated. But I wanted to distinguish it from that normal, because isolation is something we want to cure, something we want to heal, something we want to address.
I'm going to take this break. Welcome back to Amplify with Dr. Kelly Flanagan. Title of the book, True Companions. It seems that since you wrote the book 2 years ago, that the digital connection didn't satisfy our thirst for companionship then. And to me, it would seem like it's even worse today. You let me know.
Yeah,
you deal with that more than I do.
No, I agree with you. When I wrote that chapter in True Companions about the importance of analog connection and how you simply can't replace some of the flesh and blood realities and comforts and encouragement of doing life together with digital connection. And, you know, when I wrote it before the pandemic was, even something to think about. And so I thought the chapter would sort of be a wake-up call for folks that, hey, let's not get too dependent upon these digital connections. It's not the same as analog companionship. But by the time the book came out, almost a year into COVID, I think everybody already knew. Everyone was keenly aware that, I did this with my friends. We'd had a Friday night sort of happy hour. You know, we'd all get a glass of wine and we'd connect during COVID on Zoom. And it was just so abundantly clear how quickly how different that was. From gathering together, being in the same presence, sharing space together. And so I think it's something we're all really, really aware of now. I know a lot of people had that question about, I wonder how quickly people will go back to normal. How quickly will people start shaking hands again? And the answer is as fast as they possibly could. You know, isn't that something? Like, right. I've heard people say, like, do you think handshaking is done? And the answer is no. Like, as soon as people can get back to being in physical, tangible relationship with each other, they'll do it. And so anyway, that chapter, I think, was going to be an encouragement to think about it, but it was just an affirmation of what we were all experiencing.
And of course, my interest certainly peaked as I read in the book, we receive two elements every Sunday, bread and wine. Mm. They are meant to symbolize the flesh and blood of Jesus. It's a weekly reminder that uploading prayers to supernatural gods can only take us so far, that flesh and blood presence is the kind of analog companionship we all really need, flesh and blood. Still holds true today, doesn't it?
It sure does, and that's just one of the things that I appreciate so much about our Christian faith, is that we have a faith in which God said, to love from really far away just isn't enough for me. I want to come close. I want to be in flesh and blood. I want to wear skin. I want to feel you. I want you to be able to feel me and hear me. And so then we just have these two tangible reminders every week of that truth.
And so we've gone from abandonment is not loneliness to neither is shame to nor is isolation, then to a cautionary note about the digital crowd. And now you are a great and precious thing. You point out that we each have a unique story, but our loneliness is the shadow side of our uniqueness. And the question I think maybe to be asked is, how do we distinguish our loneliness from our wounds?
That's a fantastic question.
You're thinking?
I'm thinking. It's such a good question, Father Ron. I don't get new questions very much these days.
Okay.
It's so good. Well, our loneliness, I think we can start from that distinction between our shame and our loneliness, that our loneliness is the experience of feeling like we're not totally seen and not totally understood, which, if we're unique creatures, right, we are not going to be totally seen and we're not going to be totally understood. There's at the very core of us, at the center, is something that is just ours, and that no one could possibly understand. Whereas our wounds often center around the explanations that we give for our loneliness. I'm misunderstood because I'm too weird, or I'm not seen because I'm too awkward, or I'm too quiet, or I'm not charismatic enough, or I'm not strong enough. And so our wounds really cluster around the explanations that we give for our loneliness. And that's one of the things that I really wanted to just speak into in that chapter was, no. You don't need to come up with any other reason for your loneliness other than that you're human and you're unique.
And some people might be surprised, as I first read it, until I understood the book more. You write that the only way to get more familiar with the best and most valuable parts of ourselves is to get closer to our loneliness.
That's right.
How do we do that? Why is that important?
Yeah. So one of the ways that we... when we begin to fear out of that place of woundedness that we're too much this or not enough that to belong, then what we start to do is we start to hide our uniqueness, right? We try to fit in by blending in, essentially. And you can see this in kids, right? Usually around the age of 9, 10 years old, third or fourth grade. This is where you see our kids. They go to school and they're wearing their favorite superhero t-shirt, and they got mismatched socks. And then they come home from school one day and they say, "Hey, Dad, I can only wear Nike from now on. I can't wear superhero. And I got to sit at this table. And oh, by the way, I don't want to do band anymore. I want to try basketball." And what you see around this age for most kids is that they are trying to actually hide their uniqueness as much as they can so that they will fit in and blend in. It's sort of a way of trying to guarantee that they won't end up alone, right? But what they've done and what we've all done is we've sort of taken the most unique parts of us and we've hid them away. And now there's no chance at all that we won't feel alone because who we are has essentially been tucked away and hidden away. And so my encouragement here to folks is actually to resurrect, to bring back forth, to unhide the things that are most unique in us that we've been probably hiding since back when we were in the third and fourth grade. Start to bring those things back out to play. Start to show those things to people and see who gets excited about what you're showing of yourself. And this is how we begin to actually diminish that isolation, diminish that abandonment, recognizing that no one will ever get us completely, but we have a new opportunity to belong in a more authentic way.
And so following that chapter, You Are a Great and Precious Thing, the next chapter is titled, So Learn How to Be Alone. Why is learning to be truly alone what you call a hero's journey?
Well, thank you for pulling out that thread. So the hero's journey is a framework for storytelling that was first articulated in the middle 20th century, and now it's used for all the storytelling that you see everywhere, in books and in movies. We recognize that if the hero in the story, the main character, doesn't go on this particular journey, then most of us don't find it very meaningful. And that journey includes starting out in their ordinary world, being called into an adventure, into an extraordinary world, resisting that call, and then eventually having some sort of mentor nudge them across the threshold into their adventure. You know, this is Luke Skywalker getting taken off of Tatooine by Han Solo and the Millennium Falcon, and Obi-Wan Kenobi, you know, helping him do so. It's going on the adventure. And what I'm saying here in this chapter is that we all have an adventure to go on into ourselves, into the uniqueness of who we are, into the uniqueness of our story. And we resist that at first. And the reason we resist it is that it's unfamiliar, it's scary, it's an unknown world in there. And in every good story, when you go on that inner journey, when you go on that hero's journey, you run into bad guys. You run into scary things that are going to challenge you and force you to grow. And this is oftentimes what we see when we encourage someone to spend 10, 15, 20 minutes in stillness. What is the first thing that we experience? Agitation, boredom, frustration, thoughts about myself that I try not to think usually, thoughts about other people that I think are bad to think. And so all of this stuff bubbles up inside of us. But it's a sure sign that we've gone on the hero's journey into ourselves, and we have to keep going and persisting past those initial challenges.
And so tell us a little bit about that inward journey. Let me just run through it quickly, and then you can pick out whatever parts you want. But I just like people to hear it all one time. The first stage is the ordinary world. Next comes the call to adventure in our loneliness. The hero always refuses the call into our loneliness. We go outward so that we don't have to go inward. We analyze what's going on around me rather than within me. The hero meets a mentor. My ordinary world was no more. Cross the threshold from the ordinary world into the extraordinary world, always tested by foes and assisted by allies, and then having befriended loneliness, a peace that passed all understanding was experienced, all is well with the soul. So describe whatever parts of that you'd like to.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that back to this process of loneliness. You know, it's this idea, and I think we can all relate to this, that it's much easier, it's even maybe a little addictive to focus on the world that's going on outside of us, right? The ordinary world, the grocery list and the social media feeds and, you know, the news channels and all of these things. But the crossing of the threshold comes when we actually decide and commit to being with ourselves and being present to ourselves and beginning to, what I call hold space for what is going on inside of us. And it's remarkable, really, like when I work with folks these days therapeutically, one of the things that we focus on the most is, what's that moment in your day today, or the moment in your relationships where you felt that tightening inside of you? You felt your like chest clench, you felt your heart close. And in that moment, what most of us do is we go outward. We blame another person, we try to fix something, we try to get busy so we won't think about it. What if we held space for that moment and went into that feeling and stayed with it? What would we notice in there? I had this happen with my son about 6 months ago. He was going through a very difficult experience with an athletic team. He got into the car and he was distraught, and I could feel that tightening in my chest. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to go back and tell the coach exactly what I thought of him, right? But we have to stay with that feeling. We have to hold space for that feeling. We have to go all the way into it on that inner journey and get to know ourselves a little bit better in that moment. It was remarkable, really, all of the things that I watched come up in that moment. Feelings of my own shame, feelings of, you know, worry for him, sadness for him. I wanted to protect him, anger at the coach that had done something to upset him. And so the opportunity in that moment is to go all the way into the center of the experience and to be with it and to know it and to let that experience teach us about who we are and to get to know ourselves better in that moment. But it's so tempting. It's just so tempting to take action or to get distracted or to numb it up. And my encouragement here is for folks to stay with yourselves. Go on that inner journey and get to know who you are in this situation, in this moment, in this experience, and discover a little bit more about yourself.
There must be a special moment when your ordinary world is no more and you cross the threshold from the ordinary world into an extraordinary world, and then having befriended loneliness, a peace that passed all understanding was experienced always well with his soul. You write, every cycle of the hero's journey concludes with the hero returning to the place from which they set forth, bringing with them a gift for their people. And you have that in italics. What is that gift for their people?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in the hero's journey, the hero always comes back changed, formed in some special way that is important for the people that they left behind. So, you know, this is Frodo returning to the Shire end of, Lord of the Rings, and returning with the heart of a warrior and now able to defend the Shire from attack in one of the final scenes of the trilogy. And I think for those of us who had sort of gone all the way into our experience and we've encountered our loneliness and we've learned that, oh, I can be lonely and okay.
Yes.
I can be lonely and at peace. I can be lonely and feel deeply connected to God. All of that can happen at once. Well, what we bring back to our people is we're less triggered when we feel like we're being wronged. We're more patient. One of the gifts that we bring is that we feel sort of a joy about engaging in our own self-care rather than telling all of our people, I need you to do X, Y, and Z in order to take away my loneliness. We've developed the ability to be with ourselves, and we've developed the ability to take care of ourselves. And so I give several illustrations in the book of ways that for me, self-care has become a really important, critical part of life. When I'm feeling lonely, I'm going to take care of myself, and I'm not going to demand that everybody else sort of take that feeling away from me. And it turns out my wife really appreciates that.
Yes. Going back to what I guess is a psychological condition, it might be perhaps better a spiritual condition or both, the state of being. Are there words to describe the state of being that would reflect properly all was well with his soul? How do we reach that, and what is that? What is that state of being?
Mm. Edward, the phrase that comes up for me when you say that is a total lack of resistance to my own experience. So one of the things that we often distinguish between in the psychological literature is the difference between pain and suffering, and that pain is the inevitable part sort of being human, right? You're going to fall down, you're going to skin your knees, you're going to touch the hot oven, all of these things are going to happen. Suffering, though, is the resistance to experiencing pain, saying, I don't want to feel X, Y, and Z. And so we create all these extra layers of suffering on top of our pain. And I think that the experience of peace that comes with all is well with my soul is I don't feel any resistance to the experience of being human anymore. I can feel painful things. I can feel pleasurable things. I can feel happiness. I can feel sadness. And I no longer really say that half of the human experience, all this good stuff, is acceptable. And all of this harder stuff is unacceptable. To say I can be present to without any resistance to the entire human experience. And when we can do that, the experience, the feeling that goes along with that is all is well with my soul.
Mm. Yes. Seventh chapter is titled, Maybe Even Find God in It. I don't know what the condition is today. I think it's probably the transition you took from your youth till more recently. But you write about you had a complicated relationship with God.
Mm. That's right. Yeah, so
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice cold reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Modelo is your reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Tip, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
My relationship with God is very complicated by, as I share in True Companions.
You know, yeah, and it's personal. I don't mean you to get into the personal, you know,
No, I don't mind. I mean, it was complicated by a church that made God seem pretty scary. Mm-hmm. And God was always like sort of framed as this sort of scary big presence that was sort of up there, right? Like in the heavens, you know? And one of the most beautiful sort of trajectories of of my my spiritual life has been that discovery of God in us, right? The Holy Spirit made in the image of God, that we can actually encounter God as we go inward rather than always having to fear a God that is outward and upward. And one of the things that I'm talking about in True Companions is that this journey, if we hesitate to go inward toward our loneliness and our uniqueness, we will never be able to go far enough to discover the presence of God within us, which is really at the core, the center of our being. Mm-hmm. And so what good news for me, having grown up in a church that made God seem big and out there and scary, that God's actually right here and in here and loving me.
And there's more than one or two reflections in your book that caused me to think a little more deeply and to think about it personally and not just as a talk show host. We've already talked about one, is that loneliness is merely the first taste of holiness. But then it's this section on page 72, you write, God does not come alongside us in our loneliness, but as our loneliness. God redeemed loneliness from the very beginning, not by eliminating it, but by becoming it. We just have a minute to reflect on that a little bit. We can say more after if you choose to, after the news.
But, Yes, God redeemed loneliness from the very beginning, not by eliminating it, but by becoming it.
Yes.
And this is the experience that I see over and over again, is that when we can move toward our loneliness, what we discover is that when we arrive, we're closer to God than we ever were before. That it's okay, I'm going to move toward my loneliness, probably at first in an effort to solve it, to fix it, to figure out what's wrong with it. And then, as we talk about in True Companions, in an effort to sort of just learn how to be with it, not reacting to it all the time and not blaming everybody for it, including ourselves all the time. And then the longer that we're with it, we begin to discover that that's actually the presence of the divine within us, that we've been being called to the center of us and through our wrestling with this experience of loneliness. And once we get there, we realize there's nothing to solve because we're in the presence of God.
All right. And with that, we'll take this break and then come back to continue our discussion with Dr. Kelly Flanagan, True Companions. Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest this evening is Dr. Kelly Flanagan. He is a clinical psychologist and is the founder of Artisan Clinical Associates. It's private practice in Illinois, offering services to teens, adults, couples, and families. And I've really liked the book, and we've asked him to come back again to talk about it, a book for everyone, about the relationships that see us through. Let's talk about the chapter and let someone stand with you for a while. Tell us a little bit about how loneliness and companionship, you believe, actually come together.
Yes. So I've had just this incredible experience working with couples over the years. When we can sort of quiet down the exchange of blame, of I still feel lonely and you must be doing something wrong. And we can calm the nervous systems enough, so to speak, to be able to say, hey, I'm not blaming you. This is what loneliness has looked like in my little life. You know, this is what it has looked like for me to feel unseen at times and misunderstood. And it goes way back before you. You know, it started when I was a kid and it's continued in these ways. Then all of a sudden our loneliness becomes a source of connection rather than conflict. And all of a sudden it becomes an opportunity to get to know each other better, to get to know each other's stories better. And when we can do that, when our loneliness no longer drives us further apart out of conflict and blame, then we can sort of come alongside each other and stand with each other in our loneliness, right? Mm-hmm. And our loneliness becomes sort of common ground. Oh, you're human too, and you feel lonely as well. Me too, right? And all of a sudden, we've got something in common, and we can begin to move forward on that common ground.
And you write that no matter how close we get, we can't get close enough to live on the inside of anyone else. How do we do that? What does it mean to be on the inside of somebody else?
Yeah, exactly. Like we can't, you know, I think in that chapter I say that, you know, marriage doesn't end loneliness, it doubles it, right? You know, you've got two people who are lonely rather than zero people. And it's sort of another way of saying, like, there's just no, like, my wife, and you said it, I think you picked up on it in this book. My oldest son, my 19-year-old son, said to me just here maybe a month ago, "Dad, I feel like Mom's just closer to God than everybody else." Mm. And it's such a beautiful, sweet thing for him to say about his mom. She is, I mean, from the moment I met her, she's a child clinical psychologist. When you are in front of her, you feel like you are the only person in the world and she's got nothing else to do. She is just so present, right? But even she's not going to be able to take away my loneliness. She can't be inside of here with me. You know, I tell a funny story in the book about, I mean, I'm a creative. I'm writing a book. I like to watch, you know, videos made by other creatives about how messy and hard the creative process can be. And I'll get all excited about, actually, this happened just the other day. I got all excited about one of them and I said, "Hey, you got to see this. This is such a great video. It's so inspiring." She looks at it and she says, I don't quite get what you're so excited about. And in the past, I might have been like, "Oh, she's not trying hard enough," or "What's wrong with her? She's just, you know, she's too busy to really take the." And now I'm like, "No, she's just never going to understand what it's like to be a creative like me, and that's okay. I'm not going to understand what it's like to get down, you know, cross-legged on a carpet with a 5-year-old kid and do play therapy. Like, that's just never going to be something that totally resonates with me. And that's okay. And so we can each be unique and we can be different and not totally get each other. And we don't have to tear each other apart for that. We can love each other in the midst of that."
And you write that true companionship is about allowing our loneliness to stand between us, not as something that divides us, that is something that unites us. That's kind of the core of the book, really, that people, you know, really need to understand.
And one of the ways that I just oftentimes simply communicate that is just imagine like a particular hand gesture. So usually if you think of us as holding our loneliness in our own hands, usually we're holding our loneliness out to the other person. And we're saying, "Here, take this out of my hand. Take this loneliness away from me." And instead, I'm asking people to actually hold, instead of holding it out, take it away from me, hold it up so that I can show it to you and tell you about it and connect with you about it. And when we're both holding our loneliness up to show the other person rather than out to ask it to be taken away, then we really have an opportunity to connect in a place of intimacy about it.
One of the things that I was going to do that I chose not to do, probably at the last second as I looked at how much I wanted to cover in the book, I've never asked a guest to read part of a book, but I was going to ask you to do that earlier. Then we're not going to be able to get through all the things that we do, but you have one of the first letters that you wrote to your wife, and I thought that would give a tone for it. Would you like to do that?
I would be happy to do that.
Do you have the book in front of you?
I do. I do have it right here.
Go to page 21 then. It's the beginning of part one, titled "Grow Quiet, Befriending Your Loneliness."
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah, I'd be happy to read it. Dear M, and I call her M because my nickname for her has been Miracle since the beginning.
I'm looking at page 21.
Oh, 21. Got it.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, just the Grow Quiet, that page?
Yes, right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, I'd be happy to read that, of course. I have a wonderful wife and three children who, when they are not trying to provoke one another to madness, are the delight of my days. I have friends who would rescue me if I needed rescuing. I have a church where I feel at home. I have therapy clients with whom I share the most personal details of life. I have a speaking career that brings me into the presence of countless lovely souls. I have tens of thousands of fans on Facebook, thousands of followers on Twitter and Instagram, and almost 20,000 people on my mailing list. I have a device in my pocket that can connect me to all of these people instantaneously. I have a dog who greets me every time I walk in the door as if I am the second coming of Jesus. And yet, at times, I still feel lonely. I used to think this meant there was something wrong with me because I used to think loneliness and brokenness were essentially the same thing, different sides of the same crummy coin. Now I know our brokenness is about how we were wounded, whereas our loneliness is about how we were created. I used to think I was the only one who was lonely. After all, when you look around, other people don't look lonely. They just look like they're drinking a latte. So it's easy to assume loneliness is some rare disease you picked up somewhere along the way. Now I know loneliness isn't a rare thing. It's a human thing. It's also an essential thing. Like a caterpillar voluntarily retreating into the lonely shell of its chrysalis in order to become what it was meant to be, we too must retreat into our loneliness in order to become who we were meant to be. This isn't about enduring our loneliness or even tolerating it. It's about choosing it, befriending it. It's one of the most valuable spaces in the human experience. It is in the quiet that our souls grow into the fullness of their beauty, wisdom, and capacity for love. In the quiet, we are transformed from crawlers into flyers.
You may have to explain that last part, crawlers into flyers.
Yeah. Well, the sort of the metaphor that ties the book together is these three different parts of this experience of companionship. And the first is this movement of the caterpillar into the chrysalis to become the butterfly. And I really do. I feel that this movement into our loneliness, into our solitude, into our quietness, to get to know who we are and discover our divinity in that, is really this process that transforms us from mere human beings, right, into the human beings that are everything that we are here and designed to be. And then later in the book, we talk about what it takes to push, once we become a butterfly inside of that chrysalis, what it takes to push our way out of that chrysalis.
Part two is titled Grow Strong, Embracing the Struggle. Tell us, what is the struggle and how do we embrace it? How do we embrace a struggle?
So remember I mentioned the third or fourth grade kids will start to hide their uniqueness away. They will try to protect themselves by blending in. The reality is that, like, as human beings around third or fourth grade, we start to spin a protection around us, a chrysalis, if you will. And it's all the things that we do to keep other people at bay so that they can't hurt us anymore, to project a certain image, to try to earn belonging, and to earn a sense of connection with other people. And part of the process of growing into companions is learning how to leave all of those protections behind, all of those defenses, all of the things, the habits that we've developed that keep us safe, is learning how to push our way past those, out of those, and beyond those, so that we can truly connect one-on-one with another person. So when you look at the experience of a caterpillar being transformed into a butterfly, one of the more fascinating things about it, I think, is that when the butterfly is ready to emerge from this protective chrysalis that it's created, it's forced to push its way out of the chrysalis. Its wings, it uses its wings to sort of get through that defensive layer and to push its way out. And actually, if you cut a butterfly out of its chrysalis, it will never fly because it needs that process of learning how to work its way through its defense in order to get its wings strong enough to fly. And so I think this is what happens in relationship, is we oftentimes even before we met our marriage partners or our you know, lifelong companions, we built this, we spun this chrysalis to protect us from the world. And now in relationship, we have to learn to push our way out of those protections so we can show up the way that we were designed to show up. And it's in that process of learning what our protections are and how to push our way out of them and show up in direct contact that we actually grow strong enough for relationship.
And that leads us then into the next section of the book where you write, you too can learn to observe your emerging self by becoming more familiar with your protections. Mm-hmm. And so you focus on 9 of them and you encourage us not to rush it. It takes time to grow strong enough to fly. Just remember, you and your companions are one team with one goal, to embrace the struggle, as you have just explained. And the first one that you speak about is anger, that anger and anxiety are two opposing reactions to the very same threat, and they cannot coexist.
You know, I think one of the stories I share in that chapter is I was leading a couple's retreat, and this couple came up to me and they said, okay, we're about to go out to dinner tonight. But we just always end up angry at each other at dinner or at any time, at any conversation. And do you have any tips for us for our dinner conversation tonight? And I said, yes, don't open your mouths unless it is to share something that scares you. And the very specific reason for that is that anger and fear are opposing and mutually exclusive emotions and reactions. So if you're talking about what you're afraid of, you literally will not be able to get angry. They're in a way, they're sort of counterparts of the fight or flight reaction. The fight reaction is anger. I'm going to attack the thing I feel threatened by. And the flight reaction is the fear. I'm going to run. I'm going to flee the thing that I feel threatened by. And so I think a lot of us can relate to anger being one of our most defensive reactions. And so one of the things I will often coach couples and individuals to do is anytime you start to notice that anger, ask yourself, what is the fear that this anger is covering up? And what might it look like for me to express that fear rather than leading with the anger? And then once again, if you can do that, you push your way past the defensiveness, and you started to show up with a vulnerability that can lead to greater connection.
If we had more time, I'd explore such things of your teaching us that you can learn to choose your response rather than letting it choose you. We can dispel our anger by choosing our fear. Perfect love doesn't drive out fear by eliminating fear. It drives our fear by expressing it, and that every day brings with it new opportunities to choose our fear over our anger. The second one then is peace faking. What is peace faking?
Yeah, I think it's a word I made up. Peace faking as opposed to peacemaking.
Okay, of course.
Yes, and one of the things I talk about in that chapter is the idea that peace faking is often hiding yourself and making yourself smaller in order to avoid conflict, whereas peacemaking, and especially peace in that, you know, that ancient Hebrew word shalom, right, which means wholeness, peacemaking actually creates room for both you to have your full voice and me to have my full voice. Whereas peace faking essentially says, I need to quiet my voice and stay quiet so that we can get along, so that harmony can be maintained. And so one of my big questions when I work with couples is, okay, are you peacemaking right now, or are you peace faking? And it can oftentimes be a useful sort of question to help differentiate between the two.
Okay. Certainty is the next one. You write that, put simply, you have to practice curiosity instead of certainty. The true companionship asks us to trade the safety of our certainty for the risk and reward of humility.
This has happened today. my wife and I, we went out kayaking on the river that runs through our town this morning. And you know, to put it frankly, she wasn't in a great mood. And I made the comment, you know, it seems like sort of you're feeling more pessimistic than usual. Which is really unusual for you. You're usually quite the optimist. And she disagreed with me. And there was a time in our past when if I made an observation like that, I would double down on being certain about it. I'd go, no, because I remember this happened, this happened. I'd start to provide evidence that you're just in a pessimistic mood, right? And today, when she said, I don't think I am, I found myself better able to stay in a place of curiosity rather than certainty. I didn't need to prove that my observation was correct, that I absolutely was certain about it. I was able to say instead, well, okay, then help me understand why you said this and you did this and you said that. And it promoted a really lively and good conversation. So, but oftentimes one of the protections that we'll sort of hunker down in is if we think something, we're certain of it. Right? If we have an opinion about something, we're certain of it. If we say something, we're certain of it. And it's a really nice practice to just begin to say, this is the story I'm telling myself about this. What's the story you're telling yourself about it? And let's share those stories together.
And again, true companionship asks us to trade the safety of our certainty for the risk and reward of humility. The next one is yesing. What is yesing?
Yesing is
sounds like it's related almost.
Yeah, yesing is well, it's very similar to peace faking. It can feel very similar. They happen for different reasons. So yesing is not having any boundaries and saying yes to everything, primarily because you think saying no will lead to somebody being upset with you and probably even leaving you, abandoning you. There's a sense when you're a yeser that people stick around because I'm so agreeable. People stick around because I'm so helpful. People stick around because I say yes. And what will people do if I start to say no? I'm a huge yeser, by the way.
Yes.
And it's something I've been being really intentional with. I mean, my calendar can get totally out of control because yes. Well, what would it look like? That's the fear. What will it look like if I start to say no and start to say, I checked in with myself and I'm not sure this is something I can do. And so this is a protection that we want to challenge people on. When your first reaction is always yes, slow down and ask yourself, are you saying yes because you fear what would happen in this relationship if you said no? And if that's the case, slow down even more and consider saying no and entering into the vulnerability of doing that.
I find myself here, short of time, even though I thought I've been moving as I look at my notes, but the remaining ones are competition. You talk about, tell us about choosing competition or connection. The true opposite, if winning is not losing, it's simply being. Withdrawal, secrets are a common form of withdrawal, but silence is even more ubiquitous. And why building boundaries is a very good thing, and also the art of compromise, which hopefully all of us are practicing. And then you write about fixing. Over the years as a therapist, you write, you have learned some things that don't need to be fixed. They need to be felt. And you have a quote from Henry Nouwen, and you raise the question, how can we put feeling before fixing? And then there is, of course, things we talk about today, like the helicoptering. What is a helicoptering parent? Is that good or is that bad? And you go to the scriptures about how Jesus asked his heavenly Father to helicopter him. And so... And then finally, excitement, why and how have you thrown your wife under the bus at times? So maybe when we come back, you can select one of them, but we still have even more to talk about in the book.
That's
so great. We'll be back and continue our discussion. Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify. And we're talking about a book titled True Companions, book for everyone about the relationships that see us through. And our guest is Dr. Kelly Flanagan. We're going to look at part three of the book, which is the last part of the book. Why is it why can't we really value our companions unless we value our time?
So there's an interesting phenomenon in psychology, and it's called habituation. Habituation is the concept that if your brain registers something as continuous, a stimulus is both continuous and safe, then your brain will quit paying attention to it. So in other words, like when we put on our clothes this morning, right, at first we felt the fabric on our bodies, but eventually our brain said, this is a continuous stimulus and it's safe, and so I don't need to waste any more brain power on it. It's why, like, when you walk into a room and there's a candle burning and you smell it at first, and then after a while you don't smell it anymore, and you have to walk out of the room and walk back in to smell it, because your brain said, oh, it's a candle, it's pleasant, it's safe, I don't need to use brain processing power. So what I often tell couples is, you know, when it feels like you're sort of taking each other for granted, it's like the most backhanded compliment ever. It means that you consider each other to be safe and continuous. Your brain, you're going to naturally habituate to the other person. Your brain is going to not want to give your companions your best attention. Your brain is going to want to free itself up for other threats, other problems, other people who might leave you. And so we have to do something else to really resensitize ourselves to our companions. We have to go out of our way to intentionally value them. Again, and one of the ways that the data shows, that psychological research shows, that we can really resensitize ourselves to our companions is to remind ourselves that our time with them is not infinite. And oftentimes it feels like it is, right? It feels like, I mean, at least in the day-to-day scrum of things, that, you know, this is probably going to go on forever. And what we see over and over again is when we go through experiences that remind us that it doesn't go on forever, that this chance to be with each other in flesh and blood is not permanent, then all of a sudden we're resensitized to our companions. We're tuned into them again in a way. It sort of rewires our brain to prioritize them again. So this is one of the things we talk about near the end of the book, is the importance of sensitizing ourselves to our companions by remembering that the horizon is not infinite, and that there is an end to things.
And in part three, there are 8 chapters that we're not going to get to, some of them. And again, they build what you want to say. And it's, first of all, it starts part three, grow old cherishing your time. Time isn't money, it's mortality. And remember, bodies matter. So go slow. Fear not missing out. Laugh out loud. Let your memories gather. Rust into something beautiful, and trade your strength with each other until death do you part. I'm going to let you select where you'd like to go. We still have another 14 or 15 minutes, but.
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, let's start with and remember bodies matter.
Okay.
You know, that in that chapter, I talk about my wife's grandfather. We call Boo Boo, which is Portuguese for grandfather. And I talk about observing him on his 90th birthday, and having some time to think about, you know, I'm a words guy, I'm an author, right? So I'm oftentimes the guy who gets asked, can you say something? Can you make the toast? And I kept thinking about, what do I want to say about Boo Boo on his 90th birthday? And I realized that I didn't want to say anything. I just wanted to hug the man. Because when he's gone, I will be able to say all sorts of things about him, but I won't be able to hug him anymore. And I just remember in that moment being, again, resensitized to just the tremendous gift and grace of our bodies, and the ways that we get to experience life through them and through the senses, and the incredible gift that that is for us. And and so I find that when I'm intentionally tuning into the blessing of getting to sense my people, to, you know, to see them, to touch them, to smell them even sometimes, that all of a sudden I'm grateful for this limited time we have here in bodies to get to be together. And Boo-Boo, I'm picking that chapter, I think, because we get to see him again in a week and a half. Baba has passed. My wife's grandmother has passed since the writing of the book, but he'll be 96. We're going to be celebrating his 96th birthday with him here in a couple of weeks, and we get to be with him and hug him again. And those opportunities are just dwindling, and it's such a tremendous grace to get to be able to do that.
You have kind of a confessional moment here. You write, "I was over-spiritualizing the moment." Mm. I have a tendency to do this because the intangible world, the world of hurt, of heart and soul and spirit, is important to me. There are extraordinary layers of reality that cannot be experienced with our five senses. We can't smell faith. We can't hold hope. Mm-hmm. We can't taste love. We can't hear the unity of all things. We can't see the mystery sustaining everything. In this way, spirituality is like eyeglasses for the soul. It helps us to see the unseeable. This is a good thing. It's impossible to touch too much of the untouchable. However, it's possible to touch too little of the touchable. We can over-spiritualize our embodied lives by overlooking them. When we over-spiritualize our lives, we tend to look beyond time and space and place, beyond blood and sweat and tears, beyond smiles and hugs and homecomings. We can scan the horizon of life for something else, and it makes us miss something beautiful. I've done so in the past, and the cost is high. The cost is setting your sights on the heaven outside of time and missing the heaven inside of time, the heaven of light and hum and grit and aroma and flavor. Beautiful passage there. And I just, one of my favorites, and I just wanted to read that.
Thank you. Can I read one more paragraph?
Oh, please.
It's sort of a bookend to that. Yeah. Souls can feel joy, but only bodies can laugh. Souls can feel sorrow, but only bodies can weep. Souls can feel love, but only bodies can make it. Only bodies can hug. Only bodies can hold each other and tickle each other. Only bodies can snuggle during bedtime books. Only bodies can play in the pool in a strange aroma of chlorine, sweat, and sunblock. Only bodies can splash in puddles together. Only bodies can agree on the best pizza place in town. Only bodies can feel the air cooling on the night of a 90th birthday party. Only bodies can listen to the strains of Sinatra from a portable speaker drifting on the summer breeze. And so on.
And that's what I will, you're right, that's what I will miss about all of us. You'll cherish both your time here and the matter we inhabit while we are inside of time. I hope you realize this wonderful earth while you were still walking on it.
Amen.
That's a strong. Select one of the others. We still have another 10 minutes. Go slow, fear not, laugh out loud, let your memories gather, rust into something beautiful. Is there one that jumps out at you, or you just want me to keep going?
Honestly, this is my favorite part of the book.
Oh, okay.
And I think let your memories gather is probably one that jumps out. It's this idea, rust into something beautiful. I love that one too. I'm gonna let you choose. You pick one. I'll go with whatever you decide.
No, I'm gonna go with you. I'd like to talk about let your memories gather and rust into something beautiful. Go ahead.
All right, let's do that then. The chapter "Let Your Memories Gather" was sort of inspired by it was a 4th of July night. you know, kids were doing the sparklers thing and those Snapdragon things. And I was struck in that moment by how they probably will not remember this one specific 4th of July night. You know, it's one of many. But what they're going to remember is 4th of July night as a whole, that we generally did this thing, that it was generally warm, and there was a sense of summer about all of it. You know, you're a kid that's like, oh, I've been out of school for a month, and I still have another month, and it's just this expanse of freedom, and family's all here, and there's fun and excitement, and that really is, when we think about our companionship, we can get so bogged down in the singularity of things, right? This morning, is always tough, right? Yeah. Like getting the kids out the door for school is always tough. And getting dinner ready after work is always tough. But when you zoom out of your companionship and take into consideration the sort of all of what you've done, all of the mornings and all of the dinners, we were just last night, we were looking through our, you know, our online photo album, basically all of our family photos going back to the very beginning, and we got lost in it with our kids last night, and we ended up doing it for several hours. And I remember walking away from it last night going, boy, that's beautiful. The whole thing. I mean, each picture, like there's messiness in it and there's hardship. And I bet like right before or after that picture, somebody snapped at each other. But the whole expanse of it, the whole arc of it, that's mm-hmm. really beautiful. And so it's just an opportunity to slow down and step back and just celebrate the arc and the scope of what we're doing as people and as companions.
And rust into something beautiful.
Rust into something beautiful again. Yes, golly, that chapter was inspired by a trip that we made to Vava and Boo Boo's house. It was one of the last years that they were living independently in their home, and they were definitely at that point already slowing down, and things around the house were getting rusty. They had an old refrigerator that had gone kaput right before we arrived, and the whole experience sort of became a symbol. I'm aware in our culture of how much we are trying to prevent aging, how much we are trying to hide aging, how much we are trying to sort of gloss over aging, and to be with the two of them in that moment, it just sensitized me to the beauty of aging. And so my wife and I, one of the things we say is that we're going to age gracefully together. We're not going to try to tap into a fountain of youth and try to stay young forever. We're going to age gracefully together. And that there's something really beautiful, you know, around that time I was, and I don't know if anyone else has been through this, but I was trying to get a license plate off of the car, and I couldn't get the screw unscrewed. It was entirely rusted to the car. And it just made me realize that when two things rust next to each other, they rust together, right? They get stronger and more connected than ever. And I just think there's something beautiful about the idea of aging gracefully together and sort of rusting until we're one thing. And I don't think you can get that by staying young, so to speak.
I'll just jump in with a couple things that stood out to me. So go slow and... that's one of your ambitions is to go elderly slow, because this image I was reflecting on, because I was doing this very thing while I had been reading the book. We are all dying batteries as I was changing some of those in my house. So you write, life seems serious, I believe, and this is laugh out loud. I believe I would have remained that serious boy forever if my companions had not taught me it's okay to laugh, even when life is serious, especially when life is serious. Yeah. Laughter can be the silent sound that holds joy and sorrow together. It cannot turn back time and erase loss, but it can magically pause time and redeem loss. In the darkest of times, laughter can be a light. And then one more thing about laughter. Laughter doesn't always come easy. And sometimes people want to take it away from you. But they can only do so if you give it to them. So if you've given your laughter away, go get it back.
I just feel blessed to be having this conversation with you. I have a hard time slowing down. You know, the reality is when an author writes a book, they're writing as much encouragement to themselves to become who they want to be rather than telling other people, you know, what they've already become. And so this chapter, Go Elderly Slow, and the chapter about laughing, I'm fortunate to be having a conversation with you at the end of a weekend where I feel like those things were actually realized. And this was a weekend where we were able to not do much of anything, but do it together and be present to each other and to laugh. I'm working on a new novel actually. And the theme of the novel is that we are all striving so hard to figure out what our purpose is, right? To make an impact, to be significant, to leave our mark. And more I'm convinced that at the end of all that striving, we discover that you know, all along our purpose was just to find each other and to learn how to be together and to enjoy this time that we have here together. So I'm just grateful to be learning that as I go and hopefully passing that message along to others.
And trade your strength with each other. You point out that life is a long-distance ride that returns you to where you began, that true companions embrace the trades, both chosen and unchosen.
That's right. Yeah, that chapter is inspired by this observation that my wife and I have different strengths when it comes to cycling together. And sometimes she takes the lead and I draft behind her, and sometimes I take the lead and she drafts behind me. But that's what life's like, right? Like, in fact, right after I finished the final manuscript of this book, I was on my bike and I went over the handlebars and I broke my collarbone. All of a sudden my wife was taking the lead for a little while and helping me with things that I couldn't do for myself. And there will be a time when I have to help her out physically, I'm sure, in the same way. And this is sort of what companions do, is they just wait for, when do you need me to pull? When do you need me to take the lead? And I'll take it. And then at some point I'll rely on you to do the same. And so there's this sort of alternating and trading of strength when the other person is weak.
And then as you are closing the book, let's bring her back into it. And am now more than ever, you are more than my true companion. You are my miracle.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing to me to think that, I started to say earlier, I called her my miracle because I was just so in awe of her story prior to meeting her. It seemed like a miracle that she survived her story and our paths had crossed. And now, you know, I think it's even more miraculous that her story and my story are one and the same. I hope folks who are listening understand that it's not always an easy story. I mean, I'm a strong-willed guy, and she is a fiery Portuguese woman.
Yes.
One of my other nicknames for her is Spark Plug, because she can fire up so fast.
Yeah, it comes out in the book. But, you bring it out, yes.
Yeah, that's right. But there's something miraculous about saying, hey, let's do this. Let's go for the long haul together and say that this was a story that we shared. And this is an opportunity that I think we all have, whether it's through marriage or whether it's through a lifelong companion or a spiritual friend. You know, we have an opportunity to say, let's bear witness to this whole thing together. Let's walk through it all. And in the end, sort of look back and see where we've come. And I just don't know if there's anything much more beautiful in this life than that.
And as you indicate at the end, until death do you part. Our guest this evening has been Dr. Kelly Flanagan talking about his book, True Companions. Thank you so very much for being with us again and exploring your book.
Father, it's a blessing. Thank you so much. It's a blessing to have someone who has read the book so carefully and who has taken such interest in it. It's just so encouraging to me as the author to get to have a conversation like this. Thank you.
Let's do it again sometime.
Yes, that'd be great.
And say hello to M for me.
All right. Will do.
Thank you.
Thanks, Charlie. Right.
Okay.
Bye.
A few final words, reading from the book. Kelly writes, a little companionship plus a little time will teach you a lot about what it means to be human. It means nothing stays the same, and yet we all return to the same place. It means every parent becomes a child again. It means the strongest person you know will eventually become one of the weakest people you know. It means our molecules will misbehave, and when they do, someone else will have to lead us for a while making countless lonely journeys into ourselves. We are being prepared to ride the very last moment of this human route, the only way it can be ridden, alone. While shedding our protections, we are being prepared to conclude the journey with no more baggage than we began it. While cherishing our time, we are being prepared for it to wind down. The final trade is always a hard one. With a little preparation, though, hard things can become holy things. Don't forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone. And come back next Sunday and amplify with us.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly!